Blog Talk Radio.
To Paranexus Universe. Today is Thursday, April 1st, 2010. My name's Doug Kelly, here with my good friend and co-host Grant Rubendunst.
Hey everybody, welcome.
And of course today is April Fool's Day, and I'm just wondering who's a fool around here?
I don't know, but you know, I heard this afternoon that, you know, they'd landed on the White House lawn.
All right.
Yep.
Well,
they landed right on top of a bunch of Tea Party people. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that.
Welcome to the new Paranexus Political Show.
Oh, no, no, no. We stay far away from politics. That was a slip of the tongue. You know what? I say, you know, we talked a little bit before the show, and I said, let's do a paranormal radio show. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we should.
Yeah.
So, what's going on in Paranexus world around lately? Well, we've got, in the last week, a couple of new positions kind of held by one person. Sharon West, who's been a Paranexus member for nearly 2 years and been a supporter and faithful member, we appointed her to the media and PR position, public relations position, about a week ago, and she's just gone to town with it. And we decided today, made the decision to invite her to be a member of the board of directors, which she accepted, so we're happy to announce that Sharon is finally going to run the whole show. We're just all quitting, and it's all hers now.
Boy, and she doesn't know what she's in for, but hey, hit the applaud machine, would you, Doug?
Yeah, I wish I had
that. This is long overdue, and Sharon, we just want to, you know, applaud you for your hard work and your efforts, and we know that you'll be an excellent team member in addition to the board of Paranexus, and we're so very fortunate to have you.
Amen, brother. So tonight we've got John Sable with us. John's been on the program a couple times before, the Ghost Excavator, a cultural anthropologist, actor, and many other things that he does, and we're going to be getting reacquainted with John and find out what he's been up to lately, what things are coming up down the pike here shortly. Let's see. I think I've kind of done it. If you're familiar with Paranexus, you've got to be familiar with John Sable. John, welcome back to the program.
Hey, nice to be back. How's it going? How's it down there in Florida?
Getting warmer, thank goodness.
Getting warmer. Well, where I am, I had about 5 inches of snow 2 days ago.
You know, I miss it, John, like rope burns, you know? You know, I saw my last snow 30 years ago. I have no intention of going back. But actually, it's been a very cold winter down here in Florida, just like you folks up north.
Yeah.
Unusually cold. I've been down here almost 30 years, and it was brutal. I have some exotic plants on my property here, and I lost a lot of bananas this year because it was just so darn cold.
Hey, you know, to make my third appearance on the show, I want to start off by introducing two new things that we are going to be using out in the field beginning tomorrow. Tomorrow I am scheduled to do a ghost excavation up in the Shantley Hotel in New York. Have you heard of that?
No, but it sounds cool.
I think we have heard it. I think early in our first year of the show, we got a call from them.
Yeah. Well, I have two new things I'm going to be introducing, and since it's you know, a new month and a third time on the show. I wanted to talk about these two new things that we're going to introduce in ghost excavations.
Go for it.
Flip it on us. Let's tell us.
Okay. Well, what it is, you know, we're going to use a new app in the field that was developed for Android.
Really?
And it was, you know, it's a translator, and what it does is translate. Well, I'm also going into the cryptozoological field because I've had a lot of experience in that too. So what I'm going to introduce is this app for the Android that translates animal speech, and it was developed by recognized leaders in the field of animal cognitive linguistics, which includes some senior research fellows at Oxford University.
This is for real?
You know what today is. So this is... wait a minute, I'm not finished yet.
That's a good one. We love it.
Let me finish it. This is called the EVP of cryptozoology. It's a CSI analyzer, cryptoid speech indicator analyzer.
Hmm.
It is an app for the Android that we're going to introduce when I do a project coming up in the fall in September. So remember that. I'll come back on the show and I'll talk about that.
You heard it here first, folks. Get yours while supplies last.
Now, I have one more thing, too, I want to introduce you.
Guaranteed that's a chip dinner peel.
Yeah. Here's another thing I want to introduce. It's being developed by a leading manufacturer in digital olfactory technology. It's called a aroma photography.
Is that the artificial nose?
No, it lets you smell the image you're looking at, and it's the latest breakthrough in neuro-optic nasal sense imaging. Remember, that's neuro-optic nasal sense imaging, or non-sense imaging. You know, neuro-optic nasal, N-O-N, nonsense imaging. I'm going to use this
John,
tomorrow.
John, you're ruining the magic of the moment.
Yeah, so remember this, aroma photography and an app for an Android that does translate animal speeches. Two things introduced tonight on the show.
You are on the cutting edge, our brother.
Cutting edge.
No doubt about it. To steal a phrase from
April Fool's Day.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, you know, I completely forgot.
Aroma photography. That's
like
a keeper.
That?
Oh,
aroma
yeah.
photography.
Yeah, there we go. That's it.
And an app for Android that translates animal speech, the field of animal cognitive linguistics.
God.
I'm hoping you're going to put that in a blog on the web someplace.
I will.
You'll
sure
probably
think
get half a million hit.
These two techniques are especially for Brian Parsons and Sharon West. We'll both be with me in Ohio at Farnham Manor in May, where we're going to do a multi-level ghost excavation that's going to turn ghost research completely to the other side, which is the cultural side.
Cool.
All right.
Well, Brian says hi. He's in the chat room. He told me.
Oh, he is? Okay.
And Sharon says you need to be committed.
Yeah.
I need to be committed, yes. Just remember this, Brian. Remember that app for Android. And you shall remember that aroma photography we're going to use.
Yeah. God. Okay, then. So, that will definitely turn ghost research to the other side. We'll all be there.
Yeah, it's going to turn it completely on its head.
Yeah, it'll smell better.
So, John, what's new and exciting? Tell us about what you've been doing lately.
Well, I keep on writing. I've currently finished my 10th book. I'm writing four more simultaneously because I don't like to put all my cards in one basket, so I'm writing four simultaneously. We got, again, tomorrow I'm going to go to the Shanley Hotel and do a ghost excavation there. I'll be doing some conferences coming up between now and Farnham Manor ghost exhibition will be in Canada, introducing some new video clips for hopefully a new documentary show that we'll be introducing. And I'm, since I last talked to you, I'm continually developing my ideas. I've really reintroduced it, my old ideas of ghost excavation, and what's what I call that. It's now called that. That manifesting presence, and that stands for THAT. And this is no April Fool's now. Stands for THAT, the Haunted Archaeological Anthropological Theater. And what I use in that is the ghost excavation. And what we're trying to do is pop a contextual manifestations at haunted locations, POP, which stands for participate, observe, and perform during an actual ghost excavation. And I can talk a little bit about that. So this, yeah. So I'm refining as I go on my ideas of ghost research with the introduction of that methodology. This summer we will be doing all summer long. I'll be bringing groups in down to Gettysburg. And we're going to be doing Gettysburg ghost excavations.
Well, I'd sure like to join you for that one.
Yeah, well, it's open.
I sure wish I could. When are you going to do that?
Beginning the second week in June, probably running through August.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So let's refresh the audience's mind on what a ghost excavation is.
Well, ghost excavation, the idea behind ghost excavation is to unearth not an anomaly or to detect a presence. The idea of a ghost excavation is to unearth a contextual cultural manifestation. And I do that by using myself and members of my team as participants and performers in various cultural scenarios that would resonate with the activities that occurred at a location, i.e., I'd be identified as members of a particular ghost culture, and this is sort of resonating with the memories of an intelligent haunting, an intelligent haunt, an intelligent presence, recalling the memories that this person who was when he was alive to re-experience his memories. So I introduced these different cultural scenarios. I don't know which ones work at a particular time, so we introduced, these are like excavations. We're excavating various scenarios to see which ones work at a particular location. So these are participatory scenarios, cultural scenarios. We have to do a lot of research prior to going into a site and find out what are the particular haunting uncertainties that occur at a site. So what this is actually is an archaeological excavation at a site that is characterized by multiple levels of haunting uncertainties that are a context of various historical and cultural periods of history.
So you're saying multiple time periods.
Multiple time periods and also multiple cultures. And what I try to do in the excavation is to focus on one particular time period and one particular culture of a multiple time period, and focus on one and try to do contextual cultural scenarios and practices that would identify me as a participant in that particular time period, as a participant in that particular culture, rather than go in there as an investigator with all of our equipment and kind of really startle whatever entity is there. I'd rather them identify with me as a member of their culture, and I do things that would resonate with them, that would resonate with their memory, would resonate with things that they did while they were alive. And this is what is called twice behaved behavior. This is Richard Schlechter, who is a world-famous theatrical writer and also instructor at NYU, and he calls performances twice behaved behavior. Well, this is what I call a haunting, is also a twice behaved behavior. One is the social roles that you performed and the things you did while you were alive is one behavior. You repeat those same roles when you're dead, if you still linger around and if there's still if it's if there is such a thing as an intelligent haunting, an intelligent personality that exists after death, well, this is twice behavior. It's the behavior you do while you're alive. It's the same behavior you repeat when you're dead. Twice behavior. And what I do is try to resonate with that twice behavior. By doing that, I hope that I'd be identified as a member of a particular culture, and that entity would be willing to communicate with me because he or she identifies with me as a member of that particular culture.
Interesting. So you've been, but that's basically what you've been doing.
That's what I've been doing.
But you've been kind of classifying it as, how did you term it? Twice behavior, double behavior, what was it?
Twice behavior or a performance. But see, I have what I could do before I do this. I try to test the hypothesis by setting up a location, by doing a positional survey. I would locate two different locations at a site that have histories of haunting uncertainties, or that have prior histories of investigations that detected some kind of an anomaly in that site. Two locations at a site. At one, and I would have, I would record these two locations. In one location, I would use my POP method, and in the other location, I would not use the POP method. The hypothesis would state that where I use the POP method, where I do these resonating activities, that I would get a manifestation. Where I don't do them in the same, when I don't do these scenarios, I won't get a manifestation. A contextual manifestation responding to my scenarios. So I'm actually, I'm doing the POP is the middle part of it. We have the survey part of it at the beginning, where to test the hypothesis. You do it in one scene, you don't do it in another scene. But also while we're doing this, we have the team surrounding us, surrounding the scene while we're doing these scenarios and recording everything that we do. So we have we are becoming simultaneously aware of when something actually works, rather than just setting the equipment up, recording this, going back maybe the next day and reviewing 8 hours of tape or 5 hours of tape and finding, whoa, we got something here at hour number five when we did this. When we do what I do, we get immediately, we know what's going on. We get an immediate response to what we're doing, so then we can go to the next phase. And that next phase is once we get a contextual, cultural manifestation by doing a scenario from a particular time period and a particular culture, then we can focus on performing and targeting a specific individual within that culture who is known to have inhabited that particular space or that particular location. So there we have the POP idea. We have the beginning of the participatory cultural scenarios, seeing which scenario causes a reaction or a contextual manifestation. Once we get that manifestation in actuality, we immediately go into performing some more cultural scenarios, but focusing on particular dead individuals who are known to have inhabited that particular space or that particular location. So we got a nice iterative process, a nice sequence that goes from participation, observation, to target performance, a set sequence that I call POP. So I'm kind of really adding to what I had before, because based on trials in the field that I needed something to do prior, I needed something to do during, and I needed something to do after. So now I got the whole iterative process in sequence, going from the initial comparative survey to a participation, the observation of a contextual manifestation reacting to my participation, then going directly into a targeted performance. So it's a little bit more developed than what last time I talked to you about.
So do you get new information when you
do this? Yeah, that's exactly the whole idea. We're picking up, and another thing that we do is normally when you do a ghost hunting tech sweep, you go there and scan the horizontal environment and see if you get any anomalies, like changes in temperature, some strange things on video, or strange things on audio. You do a EVP, general EVP questions. I never, in this top iterative performance, I never do an EVP until I get a reaction to one of my participatory scenarios. Then I go in and do an EVP saying, oh, did you like what I just did?
Hmm.
So it's actually contextual EVP I'm doing as well, as opposed to a general EVP sweep and saying, is anybody here? Who's here? Show us a sign. Do something. Well, that immediately identifies me as somebody strange and foreign and not a member of that particular culture or not a member of that particular society. So I save my EVP for after I get a reaction to my participatory scenarios. Once I get that manifestation, something reacting to something I'm doing within that resonates with that culture, then I go into a contextual EVP and ask the question, oh, did you like what I just did? Or why did you like what I just did? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So maybe I missed this, but how do you know whether you get a reaction or not?
Because we have the team behind us with all the equipment recording different changes. They're doing a video recording. They're doing audio recording. They have the setup for any changes in temperature, any changes in humidity, any different deviation that is. We have the baseline set up when we do the positional survey, so we know what the baseline readings are. If we get any kind of reaction to any of the scenarios that we do, that identifies that something is happening based on what I just did.
Well,
usually there are multiple things happening. You get maybe a smell, maybe you get a sound, maybe you get a drop in temperature or an elevation in temperature, maybe you get a photograph, or maybe you got something on video. When we did a 24-hour investigation at Fort Mifflin, we got multiple sensory manifestations that were simultaneously happening while we were doing a particular participatory scene. So we immediately went into a performative scene by talking to a specific, supposedly dead individual who was haunting that particular locale that we did. So we are getting multiple manifestations of the five senses: drops, elevations, and temperature. Something on audio, something on video, maybe a smell, a noise, or something like that. But we are getting reactions. And I discount just one manifestation. I only count two or more manifestations occurring simultaneously to a participatory scenario that I am creating in the scene.
So you need at least two.
At least two, yes. So what we do is when we go in there, while we're setting up all of our equipment, we are simultaneously also filming our setup. So, because we never know what might happen. So maybe something might come and be curious and wonder what we're doing. But I try to stave off those things because I want to go in there and create an atmosphere that an intelligent haunting would identify with and would identify me as, yeah, he's just like me. Yes, he's doing things like I remember I did things, or I do things too. So I'm trying not to create the atmosphere of a stranger with strange equipment and all this technological devices. Those devices I use; they're very, very important, but they're not central to the scene that I'm trying to resonate with. You know, in the actual frame of the scene where we're doing these participatory scenarios and then performative scenarios. The equipment is there. That's why it's very, very important that there is direct communication between myself or another member who's doing these participatory scenes and the team that is recording from multiple angles using multiple different devices directed at what we are doing directly in that scene. So once we get, and we have like walkie-talkies attached to this, so what they're communicating with me immediately when something is happening so I can develop the scene as I go along. So it's simultaneously occurring, not going back and reviewing a tape and doing the reveal 8 hours after
right. The
scenario is completed. It's instantaneous. There's an instantaneous reaction. And I can tell you about different things that happened at Fort Mifflin in October when we did the 24-hour investigation and how this scene plays out based on some of these examples that I can talk about later.
Well, here's a question for you from the chat room, Mark. Here's the question. We used the K2 meter this weekend outside and our new ghost box. What is the best way to tell what is EVP material? Or, give me a second, chat flipped up. What is the best, okay, I've got to turn off the scrolling because it keeps flipping out of my view. What is the best way to tell what is EVP material or radio frequency? The K2 meter was leading us, and we asked questions, and the ghost box seemed to be answering.
Now, when we were at Penn State about a year ago, they used the ghost box up there, and we also used the K2 meter up there too, and we were getting reactions in both. With the K2 meter, we had a remote camera recording the individual in scene using the K2 meter, asking just general questions like, what's your name, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we were getting the responses were being recorded on another video camera, and we were getting responses. But what was interesting in that recording, while the K2 meter was reacting to some of the questions and not reacting to other questions, when it was reacting to a question, not only did we get the lights flicking back and forth, but we also got this image around the individual that was asking the question, sort of like an aura around the individual. And the aura would only appear when the K2 meter was reacting to a question. So we got sort of like a duplicate reaction. We got this aura around the individual, and we also got the K2 meter reacting. I thought that was interesting. But another thing about, here's this thing about the K2 meter. I'll give you, when I was on last, I didn't talk about Fort Mifflin, right?
I don't recall. Yeah. Go ahead and talk about it again. It's been a long time.
But what happened when we did a 24-hour investigation at Fort Mifflin in October, 24-hour continuous investigation. Now, we were at the artillery shed, and we were setting up for a participatory scene that we were going to do with supposedly trying to get a reaction from the ghost of Elizabeth Pratt, the so-called screaming woman. So while we were setting up our equipment before we had a woman go in there and portray Elizabeth Pratt, we were recording us setting up and getting ready for this particular participatory scenario. While we were doing this, the camera, we played it back, the camera actually picked up on the floor of the artillery shed 3 K2 meters reacting simultaneously. It was like blinking back and forth. You have the green, the red, the orange lights going back and forth on the floor of the artillery shed. What is interesting is nobody on the team had a K2 meter. What we recorded actually was a residual of a ghost hunting investigation that occurred before. How long before, I don't know. So we got a residual of an actual ghost hunting investigation, of a prior ghost hunting investigation. We got a three K2 meters functioning in the artillery shed. Now, that brings up an important point. I always say that when I try to resonate with the culture of the time period and also the place. A typical ghost hunt goes in there and does a tech sweep. What that tech sweep is doing is, one, it's not resonating with the culture or the time period. What it does is create another haunting uncertainty, another layer of haunting, which suppresses the historical other layers of haunting. And we verify that by getting this recording of the residuals of 3 K2 meters. So that's,
you know, Dan, the thing that's really most interesting about your research, and one of the things I always admire, is that you take it from the anthropological slant too.
Right.
You incorporate that, and I think that is a really important factor,
yeah,
that a lot of people completely overlook.
Exactly.
And when you start talking about relating to, and one of the things that really impressed me was one of your previous appearances on the show. You know, you, as you well know, and Doug and everybody knows, I'm a big Civil War buff, but when you talk to me about going out on just like Gettysburg and bringing like coffee and tobacco and
right,
trying to have things that those, if there are indeed spirits there, they're going to be able to relate to that. And I don't think there's a Confederate soldier that would ever pass up the chance to grab some coffee.
No, like every time we go down into the field, I always bring females with me because,
mm-hmm,
they,
mm-hmm,
always get touched,
mm-hmm,
every single time, and that's just typical Army behavior.
But,
I mean,
you know, the thing of beauty of that approach is that, you know, I believe you'd be absolutely correct, because if you go running through there going like, hey, we just want to talk to you, and
yeah,
they're in a confused state or whatever, you're going to spook them. You're going,
right,
to drive them,
exactly,
off.
Exactly.
They're going to be afraid because from their point of view, which I think a lot of people don't take into consideration, you're a Hank. You're the ghost.
Right, exactly. So that's what I'm trying. Actually, what I'm trying to do is, it's a theatrical term. It's called theatrical ghosting. And this is what I do as an actor, or what I've done as an actor. I go in there, and based on my experiences and based on what we call fictive memory, it's like, what would I do in that situation? I try to think like that soldier, you know, but knowledgeable as an anthropologist of what the culture was like. So I'm going in there with two prongs. I'm going in there as an actor thinking of how I would experience a particular scene. And two, I'm going in there as an anthropologist, knowing what cultural elements are important to that particular scene, or what props are important to that particular scene. So I'm going in with two different things, and I'm using the anthropological concept of participate and observe. But I don't immerse myself so fully into the scene that I lose control. That's
Let me ask you a question, though, John.
Yes.
The question that begs to be asked is, and I know as an actor, you've got to do research. You research,
right,
your parts. And I think the best actors are the ones that really know, especially if you're doing historical fiction or something like that, are the ones that really know their time period and everything else so they can get into character. So, you know, you make it sound easy. But I'm willing to bet you probably put a ton of research into this, right? Because you can't wander off onto a Civil War battlefield and think like you can just like tilt your head at an angle and you can talk with those guys. Or much the same as if you went to Elizabethan Castle someplace and you think you can talk to somebody who's, you know, from that time period.
Right.
So the point I wanted to make was that for the folks out in our audience that are really serious about doing this, they have to realize that you do a ton of research before you even get to the stage where you're out there on the field.
And that is why I lose a lot of investigators, because they don't like to do all that background work. So I spent 2 years studying method acting in Mexico City. I not only performed in English, I performed in Spanish. So I have 2 years of instruction in method acting, and method acting uses this idea of theatrical ghosting. You're using your experiences to produce a fictive memory of what would happen if you were in that particular situation, and you use all five senses. Too many times, ghost hunters rely on the visual for many things, either in a photograph or in a video clip or something like that. The visual is very, very important. I try to use my five senses as a method acting and bring those five senses in it, but I don't immerse myself so fully in it that I lose my context or I lose my objectivity. But if I do so, that's okay too, because I have the team behind me that supports me, that's doing the actual recording and measuring and everything that needs to be done while I'm in that scene. But I don't want to create such an immersion into a particular culture that I create these physical thought forms, which sometimes happens with these reenactors. They create these egregores or they create these tulpas, and that is what happens many times on a Gettysburg battlefield, where you have a group of reenactors who concentrate so much on their role as Civil War soldiers that they actually physically create these thought forms.
Are you talking about a parapsychological apparition?
Yeah, so you're saying like, that, yeah. So the, because there's been a number of accounts and people that are in garb and in attire and accoutrement.
The famous Philip experiment in Canada, they actually got a thought form because that manifested. Because if you look at Gettysburg, a lot of the manifestations that are occurring are not the behaviors of Civil War soldiers in intense combat.
Yeah.
What you have is what the image of a reenactor thinks combat should be. And you have all these weird things, manifestations going on, like supposedly Civil War soldiers getting on the back of a truck and riding in a truck, or a Civil War soldier that is a hippie Civil War Confederate soldier that tells tourists where to take a photograph. Well, you wouldn't. A real Civil War soldier from 1863 wouldn't do that on a battlefield. You wouldn't see anything, for one thing. You wouldn't be. Your fellow soldiers wouldn't allow you to do that, for another thing.
Well, you'd have to be able to see through all that smokeless powder, too.
Exactly. So that and people believe that, yeah, that's a soldier from, that's a real ghost from 1863. No, that's a thought form of a reenactor from 2010. That's what that is.
That's
you got to really balance it. You know, so I'm trying to balance it. I'm going in there, immersing myself as an ethnographer, acting as a method actor, but I still have to pull myself out and be an objective observer, because I have to react not only to what the team is telling me, but also react to what's going on that I can sense and that I could feel while I'm doing these scenarios. So it's a real fine balance, and it's something I developed over years and years and years of field research. I'm refining it more and more. So every time I talk to you, I have more experience doing this methodology, and I'm refining it more and more and more. So what you're hearing today is a little bit different and more involved than what I talked about last time. It's going little by little. I don't want to go in there and say, okay, this is the method to do it, and this is the way to go. No, I'm in there always reacting to, oh, we could have did this, or we should have did that. So
you're still open to new things. But,
yeah.
But how many people, John, how many people do you have in your team when you go out there? Do you believe in having a big team, or do you believe in having a small team?
It depends on the site. It depends on the site. If you're
assume you're going to Gettysburg, how many people would you prefer to have on your team?
It depends on who we're targeting. For example, if what I am planning, last excavation of Gettysburg in August, I am planning is a huge team of maybe 50 or 60 investigators that are gonna line up along the field of Pickett's Charge, and that 60 individuals are gonna be divided into groups of maybe three or four individuals. And each of those groups are going to target a particular Confederate regiment for example, a Georgia regiment, a Mississippian regiment, a Louisiana regiment, an Alabama regiment.
There from Virginia.
Yeah, and in Virginia, and each one of those are going to do different scenarios related to the cultural behavior of a Virginian, a Mississippian, a Georgian,
wow,
a Louisianian. And all of these are going to do independent of one another, but I'm going to have cameras set up that's going to have a you know, framed all of this whole scenario of these maybe 15 different regiments from different states using different cultural scenarios, and they're going to start walking through the fields of Pickett's Charge while they're doing these scenarios. So I'm getting two different points of view. I'm getting the specific point of view of the team from Georgia, but I'm also getting the recording of the whole of Pickett's Charge. So I think that's going to be really, really, really interesting.
Oh, yeah. Hey, John, let me ask you something about Gettysburg. Have you gone?
Yeah.
How many times have you been out on the field out there? You do a lot of research there?
Yeah, yeah.
Let me ask you a question about, have you ever done anything in the Triangle?
Triangular Field?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
What's been your experiences in the Triangle? And why don't you, just for the basis for our audience's background, explain to them what happened to the Triangle.
In a triangular field, you have a lot of physical features that cause anomalies. You have a very, very thin soil. You have a very, very moist soil. You have the geology there. What that means is you're getting very, very, very high EMF readings, natural EMF readings. Now, when you get moisture in the air, water retains memory. So what you're going to get is you're getting high EMF. If you're getting a lot combined with a lot of moisture in the air, you're getting a lot of residual energy in there, a lot of memory of residuals in there. But a lot of it is because of the physical characteristics of the place. I don't know how haunted the Triangular Field is if without the context of the high EMF caused by the geology, the thin soil, the water moisture. All of those three factors create what people say is a very, very haunted field. I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
Well, it's just a place of. I mean, all of Gettysburg was, but the Triangle is a place of incredible.
Yeah. Now, I would like. That's why I like to do my investigations in areas that don't have those physical features that I can rule out a lot of naturally occurring high EMF and rule that out. So I go to areas where that does not occur. Devil's Den is notorious for that.
Mm-hmm.
The Little Round Top is notorious for that. But the other side of Little Round Top, out in the woods, I do a lot of work there. And for example, on I think second weekend in June, our first excavation will focus on Company G of the 15th Alabama. That's
uh-huh.
really specific.
Uh-huh.
That's what
uh-huh.
we're going to excavate. The uh-huh. soldiers, the seven or eight soldiers from Company G, the Band of Brothers, 45 of them were brothers in that
uh-huh.
company, but seven
yep.
or eight of them died. And we're going to focus on that Company G of the 15th Alabama. Simultaneously,
they stormed up there more than once. They were very courageous what
exactly.
they did.
But if there is any intelligent haunts or ghost soldiers from 1863, there's one group of individuals that would be those, and those are the Louisiana Tigers. And the next day of that weekend, we're going to focus on the excavation of the Louisiana Tigers over near Evergreen Cemetery.
Tell me something, John. What's been your most remarkable experience as doing excavations in Gettysburg? Tell our audience about what's the most remarkable thing.
It has been multiple presences occurring of the 15th Alabama when I go in there and portray Colonel Oates, and I start going in there and giving commands, or I start going up and getting where a cover and concealed area is and sit down and talk to those soldiers like, hey, I'm one of your friends from way back in rural Alabama, and I talk to them. So I do various scenarios, one related to like an active attacking presence, and another scenario relating to a cover and concealed presence where I'm waiting to go and initiate an attack.
Mm-hmm.
And what I am is doing these multiple and varied scenarios, I'm getting reactions or manifestations, contextual manifestations in each of these scenarios. So I know that the idea works, even though I'm using different scenarios and different contexts, but still focused on that 15th Alabama and their cultural behavior of before they were soldiers, when they were soldiers, and after they died. I'm doing the before, during, and after, and I'm getting reactions.
Well, I would imagine so. There's very powerful emotions there. I mean, you know, what was the commander's name again? I can't remember
Colonel
his name.
Oates.
Yeah.
Colonel
his
Oates.
His brother was killed there. His brother was killed
just like many others. His brother was the commander, was the captain from Company G.
Right, he was a subordinate, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and
he
was severely wounded, but he did not die until July 23rd in a field hospital. And what is interesting is that his mother back in Alabama knew the moment of his death. She felt the moment of his death. In fact, there might even be an account that the brother actually appeared as a crisis apparition to the mother the moment of, or moments before he actually died, which is interesting.
Well, I know the brother, the surviving brother after the war, when he became a politician or an attorney or something.
And he was a ladies' man, and he married a very, very young lady, about 25 years younger than him. But back in Alabama, he was he drank a lot. He did a lot of different bad things. He actually...
It was called post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yeah.
They just didn't call it that back then.
Yeah.
Let
me tell you what happened at Fort Mifflin, okay? Now, this is very interesting to show you how this process works. We went into Casemate 5. In Casemate 5, there were soldiers, Confederate soldiers, that were prisoners of war from Gettysburg. And they were transferred to Casemate 5 at Fort Mifflin. That was my focus on one of my layers of haunting uncertainty at Fort Mifflin. Casemate 5, the Confederate soldiers, prisoners of war of Casemate 5. Now, during the war, Civil War, there was a lot of undisciplined behavior going on at the fort. The soldiers would go out of the fort through the South Sally Port, and they would get drunk and come back in drunk, or they would have a lot of they would allow prostitutes to come in through the South Sally Port and, you know, do their thing in the fort. Well, we created one scenario where I had a female investigator do the persona of a prostitute in Casemate 5. So she was in there doing various scenarios, you know, just trying to entice the soldiers on. And I thought, well, okay, she's doing this participatory scene and performances scene. Now, if there are actually intelligent Confederate presences from 1864 in that Casemate 5, what would happen while she is doing these, you know, enticing remarks and stuff like that? What would happen if I suddenly pulled her out of there and stopped her from doing that? Would I get a terse reaction from an intelligent ghost by pulling her out of that scene and just taking her away from these men? So I did that. So she was in there talking to the men, saying sweet things to the men, saying, well, you know, come on with me, we'll have a good time and stuff like that. I pulled her out of that in mid-sentence. On the DVR that we had set up, the video image, right when I pulled her out, the camera, the image froze. And what we got on that frozen image was the body, torso from the stomach up through the shoulders of a individual, full body, fully seen, with his hand and a knife in his hand.
Hmm.
We got that on video. Right when I pulled her out doing that scene. So I would assume that somebody didn't like me doing that.
Well, here's a question that's kind of related from the chat room from John Rossi. Are you saying that spirits are limited in terms of their interactions with us by their time period? Are you suggesting that they are unable to understand what we are doing now? Can they continue to evolve?
Not necessarily. They don't continue to evolve in the sense that they could do new things. There's a transformation process that is continually occurring. It's what I call it's a transformation process. Energy does not dissipate; it just transforms. So these entities are either decaying or increasing in their transformation process. Hopefully, this transformation process eventually ends up in them crossing over and becoming spirits and not ghosts. What I believe is that what you did in life, you retain that memory in death, and that's what I call twice behaved behavior. You're repeating the patterns, the cultural patterns that you had in life. You're repeating those. So I have said many times, how you were in life is how you are in death. So if you were boring in life, you're boring in death. If you were a clown in life, you were a clown in death.
You're an asshole in life, you're an asshole in death.
Right. I don't believe that you gain any more abilities, supernatural, paranormal abilities, by being dead through time, by observing what's going on today. I think it's a negative reaction. If you're part of a certain culture and your memory patterns are part of a certain time period and you see ghost hunters going in with all this equipment, more than likely you're going to shy away from them at all. You're going to get absolutely nothing. You won't have nothing to do with that.
Well, you're going to relate to the
exactly.
others that are around
you
as opposed
no
to anybody on the outside.
Yes. There's no resonance with that.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
That's why it's
going to be a cause fear and confusion.
That's why I try to set this control when we do a survey. Like I said before, in the one I'm going to do resonating, I'm going to get a baseline reading of two locations that have haunting uncertainty and a history of some sort of presence, past presence. In both of those, in one of the locations, I'm going to do my resonating scenarios. And in the other one, I'm not going to do any resonating scenarios. Based on my hypothesis, I will get a contextual cultural manifestation where I am doing resonating performances and participatory acts. And in the other one, where I don't do anything, where I set up a camera and just record the scene, I'm not going to get anything. I guarantee you I'm going to get a difference between those two. I'm going to get a manifestation in one with resonating activities, and I'm going to get nothing in the other, even though the camera is rolling all continuously. Now, when I do these resonating activities, I do multiple excavations, multiple scenarios, because I believe that this is intelligent human behavior. We cannot predict human behavior. So even if I am doing a resonating cultural scenario, maybe the entity will not like it anyway because he didn't like it in life or she didn't like it in life. So that's why I try to do multiple ones. So I'm not saying that everything I do creates a manifestation. I'm going to have hits and misses even with resonating activities, but I get a huge difference.
But you're hoping by adopting the approach that you're doing, you're hoping it'll trigger the response.
Yeah, exactly. I'm getting these triggered manifestations. Again, it's actuality. I'm getting it precisely at the moment that I'm doing a scenario. I am aware of it actually occurring simultaneously because I'm getting a reaction from the team that's observing the scene of where I'm doing this, and they immediately go from a general participatory cultural pattern to a specific targeting pattern that it an individual who was known to have been in that location would definitely identify with. And that's what we did at Fort Mifflin in Casemate 5. We had that reaction in Casemate 5 to what we were doing. We immediately did another scene where I played a Confederate soldier who was dying of dysentery, and I asked Jean-Luc from New Orleans, one of the Louisiana Tigers captured at Gettysburg, transferred to Fort Mifflin, known to have, supposedly by psychics and other individuals, known to have to continue and linger in Casemate 5 at Fort Mifflin. I asked Jean-Luc to help me because I was a fellow Confederate. I was sick. I needed his help to help me get through this crisis I was having. And we got something coming out of the wall of Casemate 11, walking down Casemate 5, walking down Casemate 5 along the bunks and looking at me, groaning there, and then going back into the wall.
So Sharon asks, so over time, a ghost can become stronger in manifestation?
Yeah. Stronger in the sense... Well, no. I think that through time, if you don't create a resonance... Well, through time, no matter what's going to happen, there is a process of decay. Decay in the sense
entropy.
That there's a transformation of energy. The energy transforms into something else. An intelligent hive eventually becomes a residual or dissipates altogether and transforms into something else. Again, energy cannot extinguish itself. It just transforms from one form into another form. So I think through time we might get a intelligent haunt in 1863 might decay or transform into something else through time. I don't believe they get stronger. They might seem stronger in that if we do resonating activities, we get a stronger manifestation responding to what we're doing in that scene because they identify with us, so we're getting maybe multiple reactions. Maybe a smell and a sound simultaneously, so that it's becoming stronger because it's resonating, it's reacting. But I don't think entities get stronger through time. There is a transformation, and I don't know how that transformation works because I haven't died yet.
We're getting down to our last couple of minutes, and I want to take a quick moment here and let people know what's coming up next week. Next week we have Exempt from Disclosure, The Black World of UFOs with Robert Collins. He's a former Air Force officer. He discusses some of his findings over the past 25 years, including government UFO cover-ups related to Roswell, Area 51, Wright-Patterson, and more. So we'll look forward to having Robert Collins on the show next week. And if you are not a Paranexus member, we'd love to have you stop by, paranexus.org, Association of Anomalous Researchers. We're looking for those who are serious about this kind of thing, who want to grow and learn and learn with us, and we learn from you, and we all share information and data and expertise. And so take a look at paranexus.org. If you're looking for training, paranexusacademy.org. We've got the CPI course, leadership course, UFO courses coming. I know Ingrid's working on an EVP course, and others are coming along too. So take a look at paranexus.org, Paranexus Academy. Also, this coming Monday evening, the 5th, at 10 p.m. Eastern, we're going to be hosting a members chat. So you have to be a member to be a part of it. Ingrid is going to host that on EVP in the Tech Talk Room. And the 9th of April, Sharon is going to host a public chat. There is information about that at org. John Sable, we really appreciate you joining us again tonight. Glad you could stop by. Glad that you took it.
And John, you're always welcome to come back. You know, we love having you on the show. I really admire your approach. I think it's very interesting. It's unique, and it helps our folks out there in the field get a better understanding and puts a little bit more tools in their toolbox. So thank you so very much.
Still there, John? Well, I guess we lost. I'm not sure if we did lose John or not. Yeah, we did lose John. John, we apologize about that. We'll get you back on here in a second. But everybody, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We hope that you'll join us again next week. And until then, have a great, great week. Good night.
Yeah, have a happy Easter, folks.
Good night.
Bye.